That word undefiled will recur in today's gospel lesson as today we turn away from John's gospel and the bread of life discourse and take up again our reading in course in the gospel of John. Jesus has, of course, been going throughout Galilee, preaching and teaching and doing miraculous things. Now, when the Pharisees and some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem gathered around him, they noticed that some of his disciples were eating with defiled hands, that is, without washing them. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they thoroughly wash their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders. And they do not eat anything from the market unless they wash it. There are also many other traditions that they observe, the washing of cups and pots and bronze kettles. So the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?" He said to them, "Isaiah prophesied rightly about you hypocrites. As it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines.' You abandon the commandment of God and hold to human tradition." Then he called the crowd again and said to them, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile. For it is from within, from the human heart, that evil intentions come: fornication, theft, murder, adultery, avarice, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, envy, slander, pride, folly. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person." This too is for us the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Last summer, while traveling to Nashville, Maria and I stopped briefly in Little Rock to take a short break. We were downtown along the riverfront, and so we decided to stop in at the Museum of Discovery, which is a science museum for children. And being a responsible aunt and uncle and believing in the education of young children, we decided to peruse the gift shop for age-appropriate educational gifts to be bestowed as Christmas presents upon our six nephews and a niece. Well, the niece is just a baby, so we weren't really shopping for her. We were mostly shopping for my young nephews. And we looked at chemistry sets and weather stations. We thought about junior engineering projects and physics experiments. We considered archaeology kits and astronomy guides. And what we ended up purchasing was the fart book. I'm not especially proud to have purchased a book about the science of flatulence, but you have to know your audience. And the sniggering and giggling and laugh out loud guffawing of my preteen nephews confirmed that I had hit the target square on. Well, without going into too much detail, it turns out that children's books on flatulence could populate a whole subsection of the children's literature section at Barnes and Noble. Now, this may be because scatological humor holds a certain appeal, at least to the 12 and under set, which may also help explain why Jesus is spending a lot of time today on toilet-related topics. Not that he was speaking with children, mind you, because he wasn't. It's just that he wanted to get a particular point across, and as I said, you have to know your audience. And Jesus' audience happened to be a group of religious authorities sent by their higher-ups from headquarters in Jerusalem. Because headquarters had gotten word, had received reports about this Jesus of Nazareth who was going about Galilee preaching and teaching and doing miraculous things, but headquarters was concerned about the nature of Jesus' instruction and what it might mean for the people of Israel. And so headquarters sent a committee to investigate. Now, like all good investigative committees, this committee was loaded with experts, and these experts happened to be experts in the law of Moses, the law that governed the life of the people of God called Israel. One half of the committee was composed of people called Pharisees. Pharisees were lay people who had devoted themselves to studying the law of God because they believed that the law of God, or the law of Moses, was the revealed will of God. It was through the law that God spoke and told people how it was God wanted them to live. They had devoted themselves then to following the law strictly as a way of living a holy life. They had developed their own understanding and interpretation of the law, and they had their own traditions about its precise meaning and the application of Scripture. That was the Pharisees. The other half of the committee were people called scribes. And scribes were not so much professional secretaries as they were those professionally trained to develop and teach and apply what you and I regard as the Old Testament law, again, the law of Moses. And it was the teaching of the scribes that developed an oral tradition, kind of like the way English common law works. It is an accumulation of decisions and applications of the law that comes to bear the same weight as the written law itself. So when this official investigative committee rolled into town, they noticed that some of Jesus' disciples had not washed their hands before dinner. Now, you and I might think that this is a health code violation, some breaking of sanitary hygiene. At the very least, we know it ignores our mother's insistence that we wash up before supper. But for the scribes and the Pharisees, this was a violation of tradition. Not the law, mind you, but tradition. You weren't going to go to Leviticus 19:5, for instance, and have it read, "Thou shalt wash thy hands before supper." No, not that. But this was a violation of tradition. Washing hands was a matter of becoming ritually clean or ceremonially pure before engaging in the sacred act of dining with others. Some of Jesus' disciples, though, much to the horror of religious officialdom, had skipped the becoming ceremonially clean part of the affair and had just plopped themselves down at the table and were ready to dig in. Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of our ancestors? The committee members asked. Because hand washing is part and parcel of who we are as the people of God. Implicit in their question was just what sort of Jewish rabbi allows his students to get away with ignoring the very traditions that make us Jews? To which Jesus responded that it was the scribes and the Pharisees who were not very good Jews because they weren't so much interested in doing the will of God as they were in teaching their own ideas and interpretations as the will of God. They were teaching human precepts as doctrines. But if it's cleanliness you want to fight about, Jesus said, attracting a crowd for a riveting rumble with the religious rite, I'll fight you about cleanliness. But understand this, Jesus said. There's nothing outside a person that by going in that can make that person unclean. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that makes that person unclean. Well, it was at this point in the speech that some people in the crowd started giggling because, well, this is the material for the fart book. Somebody in the back started making rude noises with his armpit or his hands, the kind that make six-year-old boys squeal with glee. All right, everyone, calm down, please, Jesus had to say in order to restore order and to get everyone to focus again. As I was saying before we were interrupted, Jesus said, it is what comes out of a person that makes them unclean, for it is from within, from the human heart, that evil intentions come. And then Jesus rattled off six different behaviors and an additional six attitudes that make people unclean. Six behaviors and six attitudes that make people not just unclean, but the word Jesus uses is evil. Evil in the sense of inwardly foul and rotten by way of sin poisoning. What makes people unclean, Jesus said, is not the failure to wash their hands before eating. What makes them unclean is sexual immorality and adultery. And the hack of the Ashley Madison website has indicated that upwards of 30 million people around the world are willing to engage in both. They have succumbed to the temptation to be faithless to their spouses in order just to have a fling. What makes people unclean, Jesus says, is murders. And I don't kill people, you and I might say, but someone in Harris County walked up behind a sheriff's deputy and killed him in cold blood on Friday night. What makes people unclean, Jesus said, is thefts, especially those done secretly or undercover, not at gunpoint or knife point, but often surreptitiously. What makes people unclean is also what leads to thefts, namely covetousness, the desire to get more stuff than I already have. What makes people unclean, Jesus said, is wickedness, plotting evil in our hearts, having the desire to cause others harm. That's just not me. You and I might say, I'm not a thief or a murderer or an adulterer. I don't sit around plotting other people's demise. Well done, good and faithful servant. But Jesus isn't finished. What makes people unclean, Jesus says, is using deceit or trickery to get what you want. What makes people unclean, Jesus says, is lewdness and indulging in lawless insolence and behaving shamelessly or outrageously. Still not me, you might say. And again, Jesus isn't finished. Unclean people are stingy and greedy, and those who slander others or cause injury to other people's good names. Unclean people, Jesus says, include those who feel themselves so morally superior to other people that they look down on their fellow man. Unclean people are those who lack sense to the point of being reckless or thoughtless. All these evils come from inside a person, Jesus says, and make them unclean. I wonder if we can't just go back to hand washing. Because I know how to solve that problem. I'm not quite assured how to handle my own desire to get more stuff than I already have. And I don't know how to wash away my own willingness to get what I want by deceit and trickery. I can't just shower off my own stinginess and greediness. No amount of soap is going to get rid of my own sense of moral superiority to other people because I just don't do those other things. I don't have a hand-washing problem. I have a heart-washing problem. My problem is that sin comes from within. It comes from inside my own heart, and it works its way out into what I think and say and do. Now, I'd like to say it's the other way around, that sin is somehow external to me and it worms its way into my unsuspecting heart. I want the Sharks and the Jets to be right when they say, "Gee, Officer Krupke, I'm depraved on account of I'm deprived." I want to blame my sin on my genes or the way I was raised or the environment in which I live. I like to claim that the devil made me do it and have him take all of the responsibility. I'd like that very much. But Jesus says to me point blank that sin gets its start in the human heart. That sin begins in the inner life, in our inner selves, with its will and desires and capacity for moral preference. It is our hearts that have to be made clean in order for us to clean up our acts. And the way that happens, James says, is to rid yourselves of all sordidness and rank growth of wickedness, and to welcome with meekness the implanted word that has the power to save your souls. That implanted word is God's word to us. A word of mercy, a word of power, a word of renewal in Jesus Christ. And so, as is so often true for James, our salvation, our being free of sin, is a matter of both grace and good works. Grace is that God sends us a word. Indeed, God sends us the word. The Word made flesh, the Word that takes on humanity and knows just how hard it is to be us, a Word that in taking on flesh knew our temptation and struggle with sin. Grace is that God sends us a Word that, if we are open to it, takes root in our own souls. This word is bread that, when you eat it, means that you will never be hungry again, and so you don't have to grasp and trick and deceive in order to get even more stuff than we already have. This word brings life, which means that we don't have to take the life of others in order to have one of our own. This word is faithful to us in every circumstance, obviating our need to be faithless to one another. This word is the word of truth, which means that we don't have to trick or to deceive in order to get what we need. This is a word that brings healing. This is a word that calls us children of God, which means we don't have to injure others' names. It is enough for us to be children of God. And if we are open to it, when this implanted word takes root in our hearts and begins to grow in us, this word pushes out that sordidness and rank growth of evil things that grow like weeds in our hearts. That's the grace part. This word is given to us as gift. The good works part is that you and I have to develop those habits of the heart, those habits and patterns of mind and speech and action that make us greedy or stingy, those habits that lead us to look down on other people, those patterns that open us up to the temptations to immorality. It is grace and good works that lead us to salvation. There's a story that Eugene Peterson tells about Saint Teresa of Avila, who didn't have much time for pious pretense. One day, the story goes, Teresa was sitting on the toilet, a cinnamon roll in one hand and a prayer book in the other. The devil appears to Saint Teresa, and he's so scandalized by her impertinence and her irreverence bringing these two things into the privy that the devil begins to reprimand Teresa in rather sanctimonious fashion, as only the devil can. Teresa simply told the devil, "Look, the cinnamon roll is for me, the prayers are for God, the rest is for you." That's what we can do with all those things that cause us to be unclean. Leave them for the devil and offer ourselves to God.